This is Radio Equal Shop with your host, Alex Smith.
In the age of rising seas, is it time to say goodbye to Venice? I reached out to an Italian scholar, published on Venice, educated there, and a known lover of this world-renowned city. Dr. Luca Muscara is professor of geography and associate professor of political geography at the University of Molise. Also known as Unimol, this great Italian university is located in Campobasso, Italy, but we reached Dr. Muscara on assignment in France. From Grenoble, Luca Muscara, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Should we be worried about Venice sliding under the sea?
Yes, we should.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? I mean, how serious is it? What are you thinking?
Well, all the data show that flooding has been on the rise in the past decades, and it is esteemed to continue to do so. The average elevation of the city above the mean sea level is only 100 centimeters, and that is an average. So it means that some parts of the city, the oldest ones like San Marco, are even below the 1 meter. They're only 80 centimeters, which is less than 3 feet on the sea level.
And I guess the tourists occasionally have to dodge a flooded square, but what about the Venetians themselves? Are they also having to worry about these storm surges and waters arriving?
Well, tourists find flooding exciting. It's a threat to them, but they are only there for a few hours, usually, or a couple of days. And the residents have been used to being flooded. Actually, it seems that St. Mark's has been flooded about 3,600 times since the big one flooding of November 4th, 1966. And so, you know, 3,600 times, even if it lasts only a few hours, usually, is enough to make residents getting used to it, and everyone wears his own rubber boots.
Rubber boots are the new style in Venice. Can we be sure that repeated floods there are due to sea level rise and storm surge, or could it be things like the sinking city or groundwater pumping or the lack of dredging in the canals?
The awareness about the flooding problem started after the big one of 1966, when most of the city was underwater for 2 days, with a level of the waters around almost 2 meters, which is quite a lot. And so since then, a number of studies have been carried out, and they discovered that one of the causes was the sea level rise, and of course there could be a contribution of the meteorological conditions. But another cause was subsidence, the gradual sinking of the land due to groundwater pumping or even gas pumping from beneath the North Adriatic. This subsidence has receded between 1970 and 2008, but in the past decade it's been considered again a cause contributing to the flooding.
Looking through your previous articles, I seem to find several Venices. There are Venetians, invasions by tourists, and then bought out by international wealth. But the cities, they spread beyond their boundaries into kind of regions of domination. What is Venice really today? It's a lot more than the worldwide myth of palazzos and gondoliers, surely.
Well, Venice is actually a challenge for its very delicate ecological balance between and residents and the environment, and the massive over-tourism that we have been experiencing is really threatening the city and this balance. So actually the city is under a double threat, the water flooding and the tourist flooding, which is actually pushing residents out of the city and has been doing so for the past 60 years, actually, we lost, as you know, perhaps more than two-thirds of the residents in the historical center since the 1950s.
So the Venice we hear so much about is actually shrinking in terms of Venetians.
Totally, totally. We lost two-thirds of the residents, and we lose all the services to the residents, as all traditional arts and craft stores, or even, you know, the food local stores, they shut down and they are replaced by, you know, bars and, you know, venues to cater tourism. And especially this, we call it mordi e fuggi. It means bite and go sort of tourism. So it's mostly people that visit Venice only for a few hours. And so they can hardly see anything and even less understand anything about the city. So it is especially this sort of quick consumption of the city which has become a problem.
Luca Mascara, what are you hearing about predictions for the city when it comes to rising seas and storm surges?
A friend of mine is a researcher in oceanography, and a couple of years ago he told me that we should not be concerned for in terms of real estate value for the next 30 years. And then after that, it's harder to make predictions, of course. So for the moment, we should not lose the city, at least for the next 30 years. But, of course, one has to take a longer view, too.
And there are defense plans for Venice. How far along are they, Luca?
Well, the defense plans for Venice started to be discussed right after the 1966 major flooding, but then it took them some 30-some years before they could start to become a project. So in the early 2000, I think around 2002, a major project sponsored by the Italian government called MOSE was designed, and it has been under construction since then. It is a system of submerged dams that could be risen in order to close the three outlets where the exchange between the sea and the lagoon takes place. So every time that a flooding is expected, those submerged dams could be raised to prevent the flooding from entering the lagoon. But it's really a huge, huge project. If you only think that the outlets are three, but the whole system is made of 78 gates, submerged gates, arranged in four major barriers, and each gate has a height between 60 and 95 feet, so they're pretty big. And they work with a system, with an hydraulic system. This project has been very controversial, and some years ago there has been even a scandal, which has actually retarded the project, delayed the project. And I just read that this November 4th, which will be the 53rd anniversary of the big flooding of 66, they are testing for the first time the entire system at the Malamocco outlet. So in one of the three outlets where there are some 30 or 40 gates, they will try to raise all the gate at once for the first time. So after that, we should know better. What they say is that the project is supposed to be completed and operational by 2022, although if we look at all the past delays, it is doubtful that they can manage to respect the deadline, and that's my point of view.
It's quite interesting because New York Harbor also has three major inlets, and I think that they're probably looking at what's going on in Venice as a possible model for how to protect New York from things like Hurricane Sandy, which just flooded the lower Manhattan area.
Right.
But I also heard that this MOSE system is not designed for 1 or 2 meters of sea level rise that could happen by the year 2100. Is it already sort of underscaled, so to speak?
Yes. We only have to hope that the sea level is not going to rise to that height, because otherwise the entire investment in this project would be almost lost. Actually, it's supposed to function, I think, for tides above 110 or 120 centimeters. So actually, some parts of the city have been raised. The area around San Mark has been reinforced and raised slightly to gain a few centimeters. But in terms of average sea level increase, I think this project does have strong limitations if we look at it in the long term.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Luca Mascara from the University of Molise, Italy. We are talking about the fate of the great city of Venice in this age of rising seas. Well, suppose, you know, James Hansen does say that he expects at least a meter of sea level rise, maybe 3 by the end of this century. So there are different predictions out there. And I kind of wonder what will happen to the famous half-submerged cities around the world, not just in Europe or America, but also in Asia. It would just be so strange to be born into an age where wave-damaged buildings stand out in the sea. Do you think that is possible?
Well, it may be possible. What I understand is that we do not know, and perhaps we cannot know exactly when that is going to happen, how long will that take. You know, these models, of course, are estimates, and certainly are not perfect, even if they keep improving. But I think that the raising the awareness about the implication of climate change to the global water cycle is very important, and certainly the attention to the rise in the sea level is something that immediately captures the attention of the public, or at least it should.
Luca, you are the biographer for the French geographer Jean Gottman, and regarding Gottman's system, you write, territory is a psychosomatic phenomenon, and its partitioning takes place first of all in people's minds and subsequently in geographic space. For me, that's kind of a mind-blowing rethink. We are taught geography shapes history, not the other way around. Talk to us about territory as a psychosomatic phenomenon.
Thank you for asking this question. Jean Gottman has been one of the most underrated geographers of the 20th century, although I think his importance is starting to receive some attention. Of course, if the traditional idea was that the physical geography affects human geography and human settlements, with the climate change, we are actually witnessing to the opposite, as this is a problem that is largely caused by the anthropic factor, by human activities, and especially all the greenhouse gases emissions, as it's well known. So what Gottman says when he writes that the territory is a psychosomatic device, he means that territory is the place where the psychology of its inhabitants is projected. So, as a political geographer, he considered that the first borders are first in the mind of the people before being actually drawn on the land. But if we look at the borders, we can see at different times in history that borders do change, and that there are times when a community feels safe and it would be more willing to open the border because it looks at the outside world as a resource, as an opportunity. And there are other times in history when the community feels threatened from the outside world, and in that case, it would want to shut down the borders. And if we think about all the talk about the wall with Mexico, it would seem that it's a psychological crisis for all those who believe that this is the problem and the solution, if you see what I mean. So it is the psychology of the community that comes first, and it's projected on the territory itself by opening or closing the borders according to how they feel more threatened by the outsider or how much they see the outside as an opportunity.
I guess the Italian city of Campobasso itself is an example in that it was very high during the feared times, maybe in medieval times, but then people moved further down into the valley when they felt safer.
It's totally true, and it's true not just for Campobasso, but for all the Apennine Mountain settlements in Italy and elsewhere. It's all about security, of course, and when people feel secure, they will be more willing to move to the valley, where movement is easier. But when there is a security crisis, then the settlements would move up again to the top of the hills or of the mountains because it's more protected, even if movement is hampered.
Can your specialty in political geography shed light on the failure of politics to address the climate emergency?
Well, as far as I can see, if we look at the problem with the ozone hole, which was discovered, I think, around 1985, and it was a global problem, and if we look at history, we see that governments, world governments, were able to come to an agreement within a couple of years since then, and actually the ozone hole has been way reduced after the measures that were underwritten by all these governments. In the case of climate change, I would say that perhaps there are obvious economic interests connected to the fossil fuels that prevent from finding a political solution, as it was the case with the ozone hole for the greenhouse gas emission reduction.
The geographer Jean Gottman also wrote about the expansion of major cities into what he called a megalopolis, sort of super cities. And Toronto has, in Canada, has spread all around the Great Lake where it inhabits. Los Angeles seems to go on forever. And look at Tokyo. It's hard to say where Tokyo actually ends. Do you think that these gigantic cities are now playing into climate change as well?
Oh, well, it's well known that London, for example, emits more greenhouse gases than the entire country of Greece. So the contribution to the greenhouse gases emissions is of the cities could be very strong. But it's also true that many cities have networked today to reduce these emissions even when the state was not willing to do so. So, you know, they can be the cause, but they can also bring a solution to the problem, at least partially.
Do you think more of geography and political geography will swing toward the global effort to understand the Anthropocene, as it's called, the human age, and climate change?
I would say so. At least if we look at the younger generations, they start to be way more aware than some of the other ones we have seen so far. So that brings some hope.
Luca, what are you working on these days?
In these days, I'm in Grenoble at the PACTE laboratory, where we are developing a project of valorization of the Gottman archives in Paris, which are currently housed at the Bibliothèque de France, within an idea of making French geography better known, not only in Europe, but also globally.
All right, and as we wrap up here, could you talk to us about why you love Venice so much?
Well, the city is an irreplaceable treasure, and it is really a privilege to be able to live there, even with all its limitations. Venice, of course, together with the lagoon, is one of UNESCO's World Heritage Sites. But what really makes the difference is not just the amount of art and architecture and the uniqueness of medieval urban fabric that has remained almost untouched since those days. To me, what really makes the difference is the experience of time you get by living there. You are in touch with a different, perhaps a pre-industrial in many ways, pre-industrial way of life, way of living. And this different perception of time, it's really hard to get it anywhere else. I think Venice is one of the greatest examples of balance, of ecologic balance between the environment and humankind.
We have been talking with Italian scholar Luca Mascara. He is with the University of Molise, but he's taught at other universities. He's consulted for industry and the United Nations. His book with John Agnew, Making Political Geography, is a standard around the world. And you can find more links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Luca, thank you so much for helping us see Venice through the radio this time.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's been wonderful.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. This has been part of our ongoing exploration of our time and climate change. Just search for Radio EcoShock and Rising Seas to find more great programs, all available for free listening or download at our website, ecoshock.org.